get the pass. Chimney vacant. Don't chat. If me say gala, them no feel like all we feel, that mean them no real like all we real. Me say gala, them no feel like all we feel, them no real like all we real. It's a girl thing in no heart. In no heart, touch enough gala, we no mad. We no mad. A boy that a boy that. But we nah no loving figgy no mad. In no mad. Girl thing in no heart. In no heart, touch enough gala, we no mad. We no mad. A boy that a boy that. Me no understand, no, me no understand. From a boy, no one, no girl that unbalanced. From me, a little boy in a the mango ranch. Girl, I touch you, but no, pan me underpants. In a girl world, me sick, ambulance. Girl, I line up on a limbo and a tango dance. Me touch most of them, some of them no stand a chance. Girl, I fall for me like a avalanche. It's a girl thing, in no heart, in no heart. Touch enough, girl, we no mad, we no mad. A boy better boy that. Cause we nah, no laughing, thinking no man. No man, melting in no heart, in no heart, touch no girl, we no mad, we no mad. A boy better go with that, cause we nah no laughing, figgy no man. From me a 10-year-old, girl nuffy, broke me ducks. Take way boy, girl, call me just vicious. See me a cruise, girl, me just pick up one player. Touch me, touch you, yaffy, touch me thus. Love, girl, ever want, love, girl, ever want. Talks like me brother Marcus. She touching on me place, so she never want go.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? Brought to you live.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Candace.
And we're your hosts for today's show. Today we're going to be interviewing Jack Norton, a PhD student at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City. He does research on the geography and political economy of prisons in New York State. We're going to talk to him about his research into prison towns in northern New York, including Dannemora, home of the now infamous Clinton Correctional Facility, a maximum security prison where two prisoners escaped 3 weeks ago. First, some news items.
Thousands of people gathered in New York City last month for a march calling on United States President Barack Obama to release a longtime Puerto Rican independence activist from prison. Oscar Lopez Rivera was convicted in 1981 on federal charges, including seditious conspiracy, conspiring to oppose U.S. authority over Puerto Rico by force. He was also accused of being a member of the FALN, the Armed Forces of National Liberation, which claimed responsibility for more than 100 bombings to call attention to the colonial case of Puerto Rico. In 1999, U.S. President Bill Clinton commuted the sentences of 16 members of the FALN, but Lopez refused to accept the deal because it did not include two fellow activists who have since been released. 2015 marks Lopez's 34th year behind bars. He is scheduled for release in 2027. More information about his case can be heard on democracynow.org. The United States Supreme Court has rejected a challenge to the use of a controversial sedative in executions. Three Oklahoma prisoners had sought a ban on midazolam, which has been tied to several botched or prolonged lethal injections. But a 5-4 majority rejected the inmates' claim that the drug violates a ban on cruel and unusual punishment. In a dissent, Justice Stephen Breyer and Ruth Bader Ginsburg suggested they are prepared to deem the death penalty unconstitutional.
And the former death row prisoner, Glenn Ford, has died at the age of 65. After 3 decades on death row in Louisiana, Ford was freed in March 2014 based on new evidence clearing him of the 1983 fatal shooting of a jewelry store owner. Ford is African-American and was tried by an all-white jury. He was one of the longest-serving death row prisoners ever to be exonerated. The prosecutor who sent him to prison, Marty Stroud, came out and apologized to Ford for his ordeal. Dipan Budlakodi, our comrade and friend, will soon be in Montreal to challenge his conditions of release at the Immigration and Refugee Board. Dipan is under a deportation order to India, his parents' country of birth. He spent months in immigration detention and was released under conditions that limit his freedoms. Because India does not recognize him as a citizen and is refusing his deportation, Dipan is under these conditions indefinitely, with no end in sight. Dipan was born in Ottawa, and his Canadian citizenship was never in question until a racist prison guard reported him to Immigration Canada. This initiated a process in which Canada arbitrarily decided that he was not a citizen on the pretext that his parents came to Canada to work as household help in the Indian embassy. Canada then proceeded to strip him of permanent residency because of his criminal record. There will be a rally for Dipan Budlakodi this Monday, July 13th, at 8 a.m. in front of the Immigration and Refugee Board's Guy Favreau complex. The address is 200 René Lévesque Boulevard in Montreal. More information on his struggle to have his citizenship recognized can be found at justicefordipan.org.
Three anarchist prisoners have stopped their hunger strike in Chile after 54 and 53 days. They said, "On Friday, June 5th, we end our mobilization, which was a response to the repressive maneuvers power unleashed at this time against us, against our emotional and solidarity environment. We decided to stand on our feet and to publicize our situation without letting the designs of power to be realized, which through legal, police, media, suppressive tricks, seeks to perpetuate isolation, silence, and absolute submission. We decided to mobilize through a joint decision, a horizontal agreement, far from levels and hierarchies, which the levers of power and the law seek to replicate in each and every group of people. It is the most dignified way of being in this world of bowed heads and prizes for any kind of boss. The primary objective of this hunger strike was the release of our comrade Enrique Guzman Amadeo, and also to remove Natalie from the paranoid isolation imposed on her since the first day of her kidnapping detention hunt. To find out more, you can check out the website 325.nostate.org. And those were the headlines here on the Prison Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM. And now we are going to hear a song before we bring you an interview. Stay tuned.
I'm
Time is presently 5:12 p.m. You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and www.ckut.ca. We're currently trying to patch through a phone interview with Jack Norton, who's a PhD candidate at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City, where he is writing a dissertation on the geography and political economy of prisons in New York State. He spent the past few years researching how and why New York State built so many prisons in rural areas from 1970 to about 2000. And he's also been doing research on how the state has been closing down some of these prisons over the past few years for reasons that have more to do with money than prison reform. Today, Jack joins us on the phone from New York to talk about his research. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Jack.
Oh, thank you.
So let's start with statistics. How many prisons were built in rural areas in northern New York State from 1970 to 2000? And how did this relate to the prison population in that era?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll start with the entire prison population of New York State. And in 1971, there were about 17,400 people imprisoned in the state. And that at the time, that was considered way too many, right? There were people calling for prison abolition even then, saying that there were far too many. So from 17,400, and in 2000, there were 71,400 people. So that was an increase of over 500% of the number of people in prison. And in 71, the New York State Department of Corrections operated, I think, 21 facilities. By 2000, that number was 71 facilities. But sometimes it's important to keep your eye on, like, how many people are actually locked up in cages, because, you know, the number of people in each facility varies quite a bit, right? Mm-hmm. And in northern New York, northern New York is where a lot of those new facilities during that time were built. So in my research, I look at one Senate district in the northern part of the state, where I think it started with two prisons, in the 70s, and by 2000 there were 14 prisons. And that doesn't even count the two prisons built at Ogdensburg, which is also in northern New York, and, you know, two more around Governor and Cape St. Vincent. So a lot of prisons in northern New York.
Wow. Okay, so we're mostly talking about the 45th Senate District. And I don't know if any of our Canadian listeners know too much about what's called North County, but can you talk a little bit about this region for folks who might not be so familiar with it?
Sure. The 45th Senate District is often called the North Country, right? North Country New York is kind of like a Chamber of Commerce tourist description of the area. And much of that is within this Senate district. Now, I'm talking about the New York State Senate, right? This isn't the U.S. Senate. It's the State Senate, which is like the provincial assembly, I guess, in a Canadian province. So this is a really big area that is, it borders Quebec. So it's in the northern part of the state. It borders a part of Ontario near the St. Lawrence River. It borders Akwesasne, and it stretches all the way east to Lake Champlain. And then it goes down, and so it's an area that also includes the northern part of the Adirondack Mountains and includes some small cities like Plattsburgh and like Glens Falls. But by and large, it's a really rural, really rural area.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about the people who live in this district? I know that some of those folks are summertime people who are in the Adirondack Park, but some of those people live there year-round as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, it's a very white district, like very, very white district. And there are many temporary residents, sort of second homeowners that own houses in the Adirondacks, lake houses, cottages, that sort of thing. And then there are a lot of more, like the working class people who stay there all year round. And that population has been of full-time people, we'd say, has been going down over the past 40 years as people leave to find jobs other places.
Mm-hmm. So one of the big themes of your research is how prison development became synonymous with solving the economic and social problems in declining rural areas in northern New York State. Can you talk about how that happened a bit for us?
Yeah, I'll try. I mean, it's quite a long story, and I guess I would add that prisons, or I should say mass incarceration, which is this whole system of prisons and policing and felony labels and sort of criminalization, that's what I would include it. It's not just prisons, right? There's all this other infrastructure that sort of makes prisons possible and keeps them running. Prisons, since the 70s, have been put forth as a solution to social and economic problems, not just in rural New York, but all over the state, including the city, right? It was seen as a problem of economic decline and crime in the city as well. But okay, so how prisons became synonymous with economic development in rural areas, it's kind of a long story, but I guess, New York State's economy has been in decline or was in decline in the 60s and 70s especially, and this North Country region experienced a lot of that as well, and upstate New York, especially in the 80s and 90s, had a real severe economic decline where you had shifting trade patterns and manufacturing was leaving the area, right? And either capitalists were moving factories to southern states or to the west where they didn't have where labor wasn't as unionized, or perhaps they moved it out of the country, right? And you had a lot of mines, iron mines closing in that northern part of the state, and you had a lot of the timber industry shrinking. And what little manufacturing there was in terms of textiles and machining was also leaving the area. So when the prison population started to rise in New York State, and it was time to, there are many things that could have been done to deal with that crisis, one of which was to just not imprison people, right? And then you wouldn't have had to build more prisons. But when Mario Cuomo in the 80s went on a big prison prison building spree, towns in the North Country, and by towns I mean like certain people in the North Country, like different chambers of commerce, different small businesses, local leadership, right? A lot of them organized to get the prisons built in their towns because they saw these prisons as job creation, right? That people would have jobs working at the prison. And the Department of Corrections in New York, which is to say New York State, really encouraged this view, right? And gave presentations in these towns where they said, for example, they told town leaders that if you locate a prison in your town, it's going to have an economic multiplier effect of 4, which is to say for every dollar that goes in this prison economy, it's going to multiply into 4 in the local economy, right? I think I'll leave it at that. We can talk more about, but it's kind of a big story, actually, about that. But I guess, so to shorten it, it's jobs. Right.
Yeah.
People thought this would mean jobs, and people in the North Country and certain social classes in the North Country organized, thinking if they're going to build a prison somewhere, they should build it here, and we'll look at it as a new type of industry that's going to come into town to replace the industries that are leaving.
Mm-hmm. So some of your research, to get more specific about it, focuses on Raybrook Prison, a prison whose construction was tied up in the 1980 Olympics in Lake Placid in northern New York. Can you talk about the connections between the 1980 Olympic bid and the Olympics themselves and this prison that ended up getting built?
Yeah, so the 1980 Olympics were in Lake Placid, and you can still go to Lake Placid and see all of the, the ski jump and all of this Olympic stuff. And this town of Lake Placid is like about 3,000 people live there. And it's been about 3,000 people for a long time. So in the 1970s, when they were organizing for the Olympics, it was also a really small town. And when this town won their Olympic, it's a village. When this village won their Olympic bid, they won it partly by saying like, oh, we're such a great little town. It's going to make the Olympics this pure, nice place, away from all the commercialism of previous Olympics, whatever. And they also said, like, we need the Olympics for economic development, because the North Country in Lake Placid at that time was in, like I said, like, they had, like, about 17% unemployment or something like that. So anyway, the Lake Placid won their Olympic bid, and then they had to put the athletes somewhere, right? They had to house the athletes temporarily, which was going to, like, double the population of the town. And basically the solution they came up with, and this really happened, is they took a sanitarium, which is, like, they took a hospital that was near Lake Placid, and they got the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, to co-invest with the Department of Commerce to build the Olympic housing in that area, and then they transformed that into a prison after the Olympics were done. Which is to say, the solution to, like, the problem of having the Olympics in Lake Placid was to build a prison for the Olympics. Okay, so that's one thing that's very strange. And that prison is still there. It's a federal prison. But what I found during my research is the sort of, so when you have an Olympic, you have all sorts of money that comes into an area, right? And the local leaders of Lake Placid had all of this money and all of these jobs to kind of assign. And so they built sort of like a political machine, right? Their political power increased during this time. And so in the years following the Olympics, they kind of already had like a blueprint of how to solve development problems by building prisons, right? They had already practiced sort of the whole pitch about we have high unemployment and we need jobs, so we need money, and prisons is a way to do that. And they had also formed a lot of the political connections so that when different towns in different rural areas of New York State, because there are quite a few of them who wanted prisons, when they were all competing to have prisons built in their area, this 45th Senate District had a lot of those political connections already. And they had sort of a blueprint of how to use prisons or how to talk about prisons as economic development. Mm-hmm. So the Olympics in the North Country are very much tied to prison. Like, literally, they built a prison during the Olympics, but also they sort of built their political power and then used that political power to have prisons built in the subsequent decade. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's 5:24 p.m., and we're talking with Jack Norton, who's a PhD candidate at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City. We've been talking about the political economy of prison towns in northern New York State. A lot of attention has been focused on Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York, especially since two prisoners escaped from the maximum security prison 3 weeks ago. Some of your research talks about the role that Clinton played in this prison expansion boom in northern New York State. Do you want to talk about that a bit? Did having Clinton in Dannemora make building new prisons seem more desirable to some people in North Country?
Yes, definitely. Now, Clinton is very close to Montreal. It's near Plattsburgh, New York, and I think you can see signs for Dannemora if you go south on I-87. And Clinton Correctional Facility is the biggest prison in the New York system. I think it's close to 2,800 people are locked up in Clinton. And Clinton was built in, like, 1844, I think. And it's a case where, like, it was built, and then the town of Dannemora actually was built around the prison by people working there. So Dannemora, what I'm saying, is like a quintessential prison town. So there have been generations of people working at Dannemora. And then some of these people, some of the key people who were involved in, like, getting prisons built in towns in the North Country were actually from Dannemora. So the state senator of the 45th District, who was so instrumental in both the 1980 Winter Olympics and in having all of those prisons built in the North Country, he was the son of a prison guard from Dannemora, for example. And the work I do, I've done a lot of interviews and done a lot of research in this town alone, which is sort of to the east of Dannemora near the border. It's close to, it's like about 40 minutes east of Akwesasne, probably, on the U.S. side. And Dannemora built three prisons in the 80s, right? I'm sorry. Malone built three prisons in the 80s, and then another fourth prison in the town right next to Malone. And now Malone was never a prison town before the 80s. Malone had a more diversified economy. It was a farming economy. You had a textile. You had a shoe manufacturer in Malone, right? But as that industry started to leave, Malone started sort of looking for a way to deal with the economic decline it was facing. And some of the key people that helped organize to have prisons built in Malone as a solution for that decline were actually from Dannemora. So I was listening to a radio show yesterday with a scholar named Jeff Hall, who said that Dannemora, the prison at Dannemora, was a cancer that metastasized. And I thought that was a really good image of how it worked. So Dannemora being like the biggest prison, and it sort of expanded as the other industries shrunk. And you can see this especially in Malone, where there was all sorts of industry. And then starting in 1985, they built two prisons in the mid-80s, and then a third all maximum security, like all special housing unit, solitary confinement prison in 1999. Now, to get back to the prisoner escape, it's like, remember, these two guys, Richard Matt and David Sweat, I think, they escaped from Dannemora and actually made their way to Malone, which is actually really interesting because I've interviewed the people that organized to have the prisons built in Malone, and they all said to me, they said, when we were organizing, one of our priorities, they said, was to not have a prison town like Dannemora, right? They didn't want the prison right in the middle of the town. They didn't want to be defined by the presence of maximum security prisons in their village. But that's kind of what we know Malone for now.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about whether or not the scheme worked. Did building prisons in northern New York towns bring economic prosperity and solve social problems? And what happened? How did the small towns that won prison construction bids in the 80s and 90s, how did they change? What do they look and feel like now?
Oh, that's a great question. So did development work? Part of it depends on what you mean by development. Now, I've had people in Malone, older people who helped get the prisons there, tell me, yes, of course it worked. Do you think we would have a Walmart at Malone right now if it weren't for the prisons? Do you think we would have an Aldi's, which is a big sort of chain discount grocery store in Malone? But if you watch the news and saw, there was one moment during this prison escape this summer when, first of all, there were like 1,300 cops of various stripes, right? Like, border patrol people, correctional officers, state police, local police, all armed, all over the North Country all summer looking for these people that escaped Dannemora. And at one point, they actually searched Malone. And what was striking was to see that they had to search almost every building in the village of Malone was an empty storefront. So they were just searching Malone because Malone was basically full of empty buildings. So that's kind of what Malone looks like right now, the center of Malone. It looks like a depressed area, and people from Malone will say, well, the prison slowed down a trend, right? It would be worse without the prison. But at the same time, research that's been done at a national level doesn't really back that up, right? There's been research that says, prisons, either they didn't really affect unemployment rates that much, or there's a chance that they might have like increased unemployment if you look at it at the national level. So did they bring economic prosperity? I don't really think they did. I mean, undoubtedly, like, certain people have good, quote unquote, which means like higher paying than normal middle class jobs working in prison. Did they solve social problems? Well, Malone, for example, the town that built three prisons, in a 2010 development plan, they still list as their biggest problem that the young people in the area are leaving, right? They're still experiencing certain, like, population loss. People get education and they leave the area, which is exactly the problem that they were trying to solve when they built these prisons. So there's that. Now, the other thing I just want to point out, like, I've been thinking about this escape, it's like, as you might know, there was a woman arrested who was not, she was not a prison guard, she wasn't a correctional officer, but she worked teaching sort of sewing in Dannemora. And she is, allegedly, she helped the prisoners escape, and she's been taken in, and she's been charged and prosecuted with aiding the escape now. And her name is Joyce Mitchell. Well, Joyce Mitchell actually worked in Malone at this company called True Stitch in a textile factory. I mean, that's where I guess she learned how to sew, or that's where she practiced her skills. And it seems really ironic and kind of sad to me that, like, True Stitch closed in 2000 about the same time Malone is building its third prison. So it's kind of sad that, like, this is an area where it's kind of like, no matter what your skill is, I shouldn't say no matter what your skill is, but many people, like, the only place that they can sort of live their lives, I mean, people from there, not people forcibly caged in these prisons, but people who are from that area and trying to stay, the only way they can stay in many cases is to, you know, live their lives inside, in the prison. Whatever that is. I mean, it can be being a correctional officer, or it can mean working in the prison somehow. So to get back to your question, did it solve social problems? The way I see it, it's like a lot of these towns were trying to solve, like, a crisis of social reproduction during the 80s, meaning people were leaving their town, manufacturing was declining, and they couldn't sort of, their towns were falling apart, to put it really bluntly. And they were trying to figure out how to kind of keep their places, their communities together, certain elements. And so if you ask, did it solve that crisis? I would say even if the prison did keep people there in some cases, and I don't mean the people they're keeping there forcibly, I mean like the people who are working there, even if they did keep them there, it sort of produced a different town. You know what I mean? That's all. So for example, Malone reproduced a town, but they reproduced a town where a lot of people work in prison, and where people like Joyce Mitchell, instead of working at a factory with her skills, she works inside one of the largest maximum security prison in the state.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just tuning in, this is the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, and we've been talking with Jack Norton, who's a PhD student at the CUNY Graduate Center in New York City. We've been talking about, specifically right now, the town Dannemora, where two folks escaped from the maximum security Clinton Correctional Facility 3 weeks ago, and what the towns in that area have felt like since many, many prisons were built there between 1970 and 2000. We're going to change tracks a little bit right now. So Jack mentions in his research that New York has actually closed 11 prisons since 2009, which reflects a slight decrease in the state's prison population, but also an attempt to cut budget costs as part of austerity measures. And there have actually been demonstrations by residents in North Country against the closure of these prisons. So can you talk a bit more about the political context today around prisons in New York State? What does it mean that the state is closing prisons and that some folks are protesting the closures?
Okay, great question. What does it mean that the state is closing prisons? Well, the prison population, the number of people locked up in state prisons right now, I think is hovering around 54,000 people. So that, like I said, it peaked at 72,000 around that it in the year 2000, and then it went down to 54,000 people. So there just aren't as many people in prison as there were. Now we need to remember that in 1970, there were like 12,400 people in prison, and that was way, way, way too many, right? So when I say there's a slight decrease in the prison population, I don't want to take away from the fact that because of the reforms to the Rockefeller drug laws and various organizing around the state that prison population has, that decreases importance, right? That's a lot of people's lives. At the same time, that's not really decarceration, right? That is just a decrease in the prison population. So various governors during this decrease have tried to close prisons. The first governor that was successful, or I would say kind of successful, was Patterson, who preceded our current governor, who was Andrew Cuomo. Now, Andrew Cuomo is the son of the late Governor Mario Cuomo, who is the governor who actually built the most of these prisons. So that is kind of that's something to keep in mind. But Patterson was able to close a couple of the prisons, very small ones. He faced a lot of opposition from people, especially in Ogdensburg, St. Lawrence River. And Cuomo in 2011, during his State of the State speech, which is like the big speech he makes in January at the beginning of the year, he announced that he was going to start closing prisons and juvenile facilities across the state. And I think his exact words were, prisons, we can't lock people up, or prisons can't function as a jobs program. If people want jobs, we'll get them jobs. So he attacked this idea of prisons as development head on, and he started announcing prisons that would be closed. And he, and I say he because it's been kind of like not a secretive process, but not very transparent at all, right? But the only thing that's clear is that it's been coming from the governor's office. So Cuomo has been able to close like 11 prisons. And so what does this mean? It's unclear still. I mean, I guess I would point out that the 11 prisons that have been closed are very small prisons, right? So, for example, there are 2,800 people or so locked up at Dannemora Clinton Correctional Facility. But, you know, a lot, and so 11 prisons can be misleading because some of these prisons just had like a few hundred people locked up, which is significant, right? First of all, it's not like they let these people out of prison. They sort of consolidated the prison population into other prisons, right? So nobody got out because they were closing prisons. What they did is they consolidated people into other prisons, shut down a few of the smaller, like lower security prisons, and then have auctioned them off to, in general, to like the highest bidder, right, at public auction. And the highest bidder has not. So nothing much has come of these facilities. So if I sound like I'm sort of hemming and hawing, it's because we are all really happy, of course, that prisons are shut down, right? We want them all closed and torn down. But at the same time, these are small, lower security prisons that they're taking down, which means that a greater percentage of people locked up in New York State are in higher security prisons now. And they've been sort of, and the other interesting thing is that Andrew Cuomo has sort of closed prisons around the state. So there have been a few small prisons closed in the North Country, Lion Mountain, for example, Camp Gabriel, Chateauguay in the recent closures. But there's also Arthur Kill Prison in Staten Island was closed, which is probably the state prison closest to the origins of most of the people in prison in New York State who come from New York City. So what does it mean? I think it means that we're being given sort of like cutting prisons, closing a few down in the name of fiscal austerity. And what I'm afraid of is that that's going to be presented to us as some kind of prison reform, right? Like New York is doing this amazing job of keeping people, of somehow like decarcerating and making this mass incarceration, like sort of fixing mass incarceration, when mass incarceration hasn't really been fixed at all. It's just been tweaked, and it's still around, right? There's still all these cops in New York City. There are still 55,000 people or 54,000 people locked up in cages in the state system. And New York State still has this expanded, enhanced capacity to criminalize people and ruin their lives through the system, right? That hasn't actually changed. There's been slight shift. But there are shifts that we can still consider victories, actually.
Mm-hmm. So let's try and get through these last two questions a bit more quickly. Why analyze mass incarceration on the level of states and cities? A lot of people in the U.S. at least talk about it nationally, and we hear a lot about California and a bit about New York because of where we are, but I think a lot of people are analyzing the situation nationally.
Right. Well, California is very important, and New York is important. I say that we need to analyze at the level of the state government because at state prison systems, because that's where most people are locked up still. Most people in the country are locked up in state systems, not at the federal level, although the federal level is important. So it's important that we keep our eye on that fact. And it's important that in our activism, if we're trying to actually win and to get people out of cages, right, that we need to do a lot of that work at the state level. And to be able to do that, I would argue we need to understand the different ways that these state systems work, because they vary quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening in California isn't exactly what's happening in New York, isn't exactly what's happening in Louisiana. And those details, they matter quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. So you were getting into this a bit in the question about what the closures mean. In your research, you talk about prison politics in New York State through the lens of abolitionist strategies versus reformist strategies. Do you want to talk about the difference between those two a bit and a bit about why you focus on abolition?
Yeah, now abolition means it means taking down the system of mass incarceration and not seeing punishment and police and prisons as the answer to social and economic problems. Now, that doesn't mean that, say, I'm not against reforms that get people out of cages. But I think we need to be careful about going for reforms that strengthen the system as a whole. So, for example, we need to be careful, because those aren't abolitionist reforms, those would be like reformist reforms, right? So we want to take down the walls. We want to take bricks out of the wall with our campaign. We don't want to put, like, fresh paint, fresh coats of paint on the wall. So, for example, I'm skeptical of campaigns that say, you know, they say, well, these types of people are innocent and they don't belong in prison. You know what I mean? Because, honestly, nobody belongs in a prison, right? The prison can't be the solution to our social and economic problems. So I guess through the lens of abolition, if we're actually looking at reformist work, we need reforms that don't strengthen this idea that some people are criminal and they belong in cages, right? And we need to look at how, if we're going to try to change the system incrementally, we need to do it in ways that don't actually strengthen it. And it's very confusing. For example, Andrew Cuomo has been trying to raise the age of people that can be tried as adults in New York. Right now in New York State, if you're arrested and convicted of a felony and you're like 16 or 17 years old, you automatically go to state prison as an adult and you kind of raise the age. But you have to be careful because some of those bills that have been floated or some of those proposals have also included like harsher penalties for other crimes, right? And that's exactly the type of thing we need to be really careful of. We can't work towards reforms that are going to validate prison as a solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for talking to us, Jack. For those of you who are just tuning in, this is the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. We've been talking with Jack Norton about the political economy of prison towns in northern New York State. And you can check out Jack online. Jack, do you want to give a bit of a shout out how people can find your research online?
Yeah, I guess I have this website, which is my name, .co, jacknorton.co, and I post some of my research there. And if you're ever in New York City, I'm at the CUNY Graduate Center in the Earth and Environmental Sciences Department, which is a geography department. So please come find me sometime. Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you so much.
This is Michelle Mendege Ocello, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Keep it locked.
Better run on the run, cause dad is home. Dad is sweet on the porch, a little too sweet. And every night the man should be...
Hey, guys don't wear white. Every day I work hard. At night I spend a restless time. Those rich kids and all their lazy money. They can't or they cannot do mine. Tell your mama and your papa. Sometimes good guys don't wear white. Dirty mind, all the messed up chicks, all the changing times, white filth and easy living. You can't come close to the love that I've given to tell your mama and your papa. Sometimes good guys don't wear white. They don't wear white. They don't wear.
And that was Minor Threat here on the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. The time is 5:48 p.m. And next up, we have an interview from the Prison Voices Project in Hudson, New York. The episode aired yesterday morning and included an interview with Khalil Cumberbatch, who was locked up in prison in the New York State system, and shares his thoughts on media coverage of the prison escapees from Clinton Correctional and the impact of the escapes on folks currently incarcerated in upstate New York.
Khalil Cumberbatch, who has previously been a guest on our show. Khalil is a formerly incarcerated advocate for social justice movements. He has worked within the reentry community in New York City since 2010, when he was released after serving almost 7 years in the New York State prison system. Khalil currently serves as policy associate for the Legal Action Center. He also consults with the Immigrant Defense Project. In December 2014, Khalil was one of two recipients to receive an executive pardon from New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo to prevent his deportation from the United States. Khalil was also recently selected from over 110 applicants as one of 20 leaders in Just Leadership USA's 2015 inaugural Leading with Conviction Development Program. I spoke with Khalil about his thoughts about the escapes at Dannemora. He begins by talking about how the escape has exposed the limits of the State Department of Corrections, known as DOCS, particularly as far as its impact on families.
I think that it's important to keep in mind the impact that this has on the 57,000 or so other men and women, and in some cases children, who are underneath the care, custody, and control of the Department of Corrections. And more importantly, I think it's important to highlight the impact that this situation is going to have on families, not only now that we can quote-unquote rest easy because the two individuals were either captured or killed, right? So obviously Clinton, as a correctional facility, was locked down. Ultimately, I know at least one other maximum security prison was locked down. And when a facility is locked down, that means that people don't get their family reunion visits, people don't get their regular contact visits, people aren't able to contact their families. You know, this happened around the end of the school year, and, you know, people have families that are graduating, children that are moving up in grades, and this is a very sensitive time of the year on top of the fact that it was Father's Day. So, you know, this is a time of the year where, you know, a lot of people are reaching out to their families, particularly people who haven't done so throughout other parts of the year. And because of DOCS ineffectiveness of maintaining public safety, these people were ultimately impacted by that. The consequences that people on the inside are going to suffer is just going to be, you know, DOCS's knee-jerk reaction is not to identify systemic problems that led to that. It's going to be about punishing the people who are under their care, custody, and control. So what's more than likely going to happen is that that security is going to trump everything. So, you know, we can expect harsher regulations when it comes to contact visits. I've already heard on one visit at one correctional facility that contact visits now are strictly enforced. So you get one kiss in the beginning. You cannot sit next to the person who's incarcerated. You have to sit across the table. Children can't even come over and greet their parents or loved ones.
I'm speaking with Khalil Cumberbatch, a member of the national organization Just Leadership USA's cohort of formerly incarcerated leaders who are advocating for the U.S. prison system to be cut in half by 2030. Cumberbatch and I discussed the ways that the Dannemora escape was framed by Governor Cuomo and the national media.
So I think Governor Cuomo's response to the two men escaping has been twofold. One, he obviously, and he has said this on public interviews, that he feels like the buck stops with him. So, you know, he's going to be the hands-on governor, right? He's going to be the one that's shimmying down the tunnel, the same exact tunnel that these men dug. He's going to be at press conferences. He's going to be at any major events that are unfolding with the search of them. But ultimately, and this is rhetoric that's just been continued to be perpetrated in the media, is that these people were convicted murderers. These people were convicted killers. So much so that, you know, that all that is now, while that is indeed according to a court of law is the truth, meaning that both of them were found guilty of murder, the reality is that perpetuation of these people are armed and potentially dangerous, you know, led to what I believe to be the reason why these men were treated as violent animals and ultimately slaughtered. I mean, one of them was shot multiple times. Allegedly, you know, he had a weapon. The other one was shot in the back, running away. So obviously he's not posing any threat. And I think that a lot of that is fueled by the rhetoric that not only came from Governor Cuomo, but was predominantly perpetuated by mainstream media, that these two people were convicted killers, that these two people were, you know, somehow barbarous animals that needed to be treated as such. And while the circumstances of one man's case does ultimately shed light on some very horrific things that could happen to any human being, the reality is that, you know, these two men were escaping a punishment from very clever and very innovative means. And a lot of that had to do with deception. A lot of that had to do with deceiving people. None of it had to do with anything violent. So again, if we're talking about judging people for who they are now and not who they were, you know, these men were ultimately trialed and ultimately found guilty again because of a crime that happened how many ever years ago for each one of them. So, you know, these two men were obvious, you know, and when that happens, it totally overlooks the fact that they were in honor block, which regardless of whatever the media says the conditions are in honor block, the reality is that they had to display some form of positive behavior to get into honor block. But yet and still, all of that was disregarded, and they were treated as if they escaped from prison through violent means. And unfortunately, we saw that with the death of one man and the attempted death of another. I mean, honestly, if this was a trial, you know, both men would be charged with nonviolent crimes. I mean, you know, really and truly, you know, there's nothing, they didn't brandish any weapons. Allegedly, one of them had a weapon when he was, when the officers attempted to arrest him. But, I mean, outside of that, in terms of the incidences surrounding the main crime, which, again, could have taken months to plan, all involved nonviolent crimes, right? And I mean, as far as I know, even their quote-unquote co-conspirators, alleged co-conspirators, you know, even they will be charged with nonviolent crimes.
You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. I'm Alexandra Cox, a member of the Prison Voices Project Radio Collective. Our guest is Khalil Cumberbatch, who works with the Legal Action Center in New York City. We discussed the impact that the escapes would have on the fate of 51-year-old Joyce Mitchell, a civilian employee who allegedly helped the men with their escape plan. We talked about the focus of the media story on Mitchell over Gene Palmer, another employee who assisted the men in their escape, and the broader implications for our thinking about the impact of women in the criminal justice system.
You know, the reality is that the correctional officer and the civilian who allegedly were coerced by these two individuals are really, you know, they're a product of an environment that is dependent upon corrections. And when two men are able to offer them something a little different, whether that's through monetary means or whether that's through, you know, just a different lifeline of showing someone that you care about them, these people fall prey to that. And if you ask me, I don't think that they should be, you know, I don't think that they should be the scapegoats, which unfortunately they will be, more than likely the woman more than the man. That aspect of the story, which is yet to really fully unfold, is going to be submerged in patriarchy, high, you know, sexism, you know, classism, and a whole bunch of other isms that will maybe sometimes overtly, but in many times covertly, be highlighted and perpetuated in mainstream media. This is really a reflection of the inadequacies of DOCS. That DOCS within itself, you know, that their three major pillars are care, custody, and control. And while they've taken some minute steps towards trying to adequately address people's reentry, towards, you know, increasing public safety, the reality is that Department of Corrections, the plan, you know, the way that they move in terms of achieving their goals is not effective. And this is just another, this is another highlight of that. And the only reason that we really know of this is because it was a maximum security prison, because it involved two quote unquote murderers, and that it was the ultimate story that just, you know, it was the ultimate sexy story already in a package just waiting to be written.
That was a rebroadcast from the Prison Voices Project podcast, which airs on 90.7 FM in Hudson, New York. You can check out the entire episode online at wavefarm.org/archive/J3Q4HK. This has been the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Our next show airs on Friday, July 24th at 11 a.m. Thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Virginia.
And my name is Candace.
And we've been your hosts for today.
The news brought to you live.